Radio.
Christianity and the Origins of Freedom. A lecture at the University of Notre Dame, Australia, provided by Senator George Brandis, Attorney General of the Commonwealth of Australia.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Professor Quinlan. Can I acknowledge the distinguished guests who have graced us with their presence? Justice Francois Kunsch from the Supreme Court of New South Wales, other members of the judiciary, members of the Parliament of New South Wales. I see my friend Professor Triggs, the President of the Australian Human Rights Commission, among us. Thank you, Gillian, for being here. I believe Professor Croucher, the Chair of the Australian Law Reform Commission, is also here. There you are, other distinguished guests. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much indeed for turning out in such large numbers this evening. I feel very honoured to have been invited by the University of Notre Dame to give the third annual lecture on religious liberty. This university, now in its 25th year, stands out among Australian universities not just for its standards of scholarship and teaching, but in its dedication to the pastoral care of its students. That ethic of pastoral care, grounded in traditional Catholic values, is a cornerstone of your success. One of the 10 steps in Notre Dame's statement to achieve its objects as a Catholic university is, quote, being openly and unequivocally Catholic, but welcoming people of all faiths and none at all to the Notre Dame community. It is this ethic which goes to the heart of what I wish to speak of tonight. I am myself a product of the Catholic tradition, specifically the Augustinian tradition. I had most of my schooling at Villanova College in Brisbane. The Augustinian tradition is one which places a very high value upon scholarship. St. Augustine's injunction, tolle lege, take up and read, was impressed upon us as schoolboys. We hear much of the abundance of Jesuit-educated members of Tony Abbott's government. I sometimes tease him that the Jesuits are the church's politicians, but the Augustinians are the church's intellectuals. I will have more to say about St. Augustine later in this lecture. Australia has in recent years had much debate, some would say too much debate, about human rights. Much of that debate has had an aggressive, almost hectoring tone. Too often, it has been one-sided, as if there were a received body of doctrine about human rights, which was beyond challenge, to question which was the secular equivalent of heresy. One of my objectives as Attorney General has been to restore balance and pluralism to the human rights debate by reintroducing into the discussion the shamefully neglected but most fundamental of all rights, of all human rights, the right to personal freedom. Of course, the nature and scope of the freedoms we enjoy will always be contestable, just as the content, limits and relationships between other human rights will also be contestable. But no one can be taken seriously in the human rights debate if they do not accept the centrality to that debate of the freedom of the individual. One of the fundamental freedoms of which we have heard far too little when we speak about human rights is the right to religious freedom. In fact, not only has religious freedom been neglected, it has actually been the subject of open attack from those who dominate much of our political discourse, particularly in the national broadcaster and the Fairfax media. Almost invariably, their targets have been the Christian churches, and in particular the Catholic Church, and people of Jewish faith. Indeed, so deaf have we become to attacks upon religious liberty, so accepting have we been of the open scorn with which their tenets, their liturgy, their customs, their clergy, and their congregations have been derided. But the great Dyson Heydon, delivering the Acton Lecture in April this year, was moved to describe anti-Catholicism in modern Australia as, quote, the racism of the intellectuals. Associated with the critique of Christianity has been the presumption that human rights are a secular construct. It is this assertion that I want to challenge tonight. In doing so, I wish to draw in particular upon the work of the great Oxford intellectual historian Larry Seedentop, and more particularly on his magisterial new work, Inventing the Individual, The Origins of Western Liberalism, which was published earlier this year. It is a long time since a work of political philosophy has made such a profound impact on my thinking. And Seedentop's conclusion that, to quote him, liberalism can be described as the child of Christianity, forces us to rethink many of our most fundamental assumptions about the intellectual history of the West. Much of what I have to say in this lecture is drawn from his argument. Since at least the middle of the 19th century, and in particular under the influence of the Swiss historian Jacob Burckhardt and his school, Western scholars have in general been content with the assumption that the origins of liberalism may be traced to the discovery or the rediscovery of the individual at about the time of the Italian Renaissance, and have drawn a line from there through the Reformation and the Enlightenment to the emergence of our modern understanding of freedom. The preceding ages, even the glories of the High Middle Ages, was seen as a time of darkness and intellectual aridity, in which the dominance of the Catholic Church crushed intellectual inquiry in general and freedom in particular. According to Seedentop, it is a profound error to regard the Renaissance as making a decisive break with what had gone before in Europe. If the fundamental feature of modernity is an individuated model of society, a model in which the individual, rather than the family, clan, or caste, is the basic social unit, then it is important to distinguish that test from other criteria. Celebration of the Renaissance has confused the emergence of what is better called the pursuit of individuality, an aesthetic notion, with the invention of the individual, a moral notion. And that foundation, that the individual person as a discrete and unique moral agent, had already been laid well before the time of the Renaissance, in the theology of the Catholic Church and the writings of the Church Fathers, the canon lawyers, and is ultimately traceable to the Gospels themselves. To quote Seedentop again, the view that the Renaissance and its aftermath marked the advent of the modern world is mistaken. By the 15th century, canon lawyers and philosophers had already asserted that experience is essentially the experience of individuals, that a range of fundamental rights ought to protect individual agency, that the final authority of any association is to be found in its members. These are the stuff of modernity. These elements began to spread from the clerical elite into university education and affect popular attitudes. In doing so, they shaped egalitarian moral intuitions. The foundation of modern Europe lay in the long, difficult process of converting a moral claim into a social status. It was the pursuit of belief in equality of souls that made the conversion possible. A commitment to individual liberty sprang from that. Combining those two values gave rise to the principle which more than any other has defined modern liberal thinking, the principle of equal liberty. Yet it is far from clear that the Italian Renaissance did much to explore or develop that principle. According to this view, the idea of autonomous moral agency, the essential prerequisite of the liberal view of society, can be directly traced to the Christian belief in the moral equality of every human soul. And we may identify that notion in the teachings of Jesus as elaborated by St. Paul, by St. Augustine, and the great Catholic theologians of the Middle Ages. Early Christianity represented a radically different view of society than that which had dominated the classical world, where the notion of the individual may have had an aesthetic significance, celebrated, for instance, in sculpture, but where the idea of an individual soul, uniquely precious to God, whose well-being, irrespective of social status, was of equal concern to God, was unknown. It is the moral prerequisite of a philosophy based on individual freedom. In St. Paul's letter to the Galatians, he writes, "For you were called to freedom, brethren. Only do not use your freedom as an opportunity for the flesh, but through love be servants of one another. For the whole world is fulfilled, the whole law is fulfilled in one word, in the statement, you shall love your neighbour as yourself." The influence of St. Paul on early Christian thinking is profound and decisive. It was he, more than any other person, who built a congregation of believers from a small sect at the eastern extremities of the Roman Empire into a movement that would, within less than three centuries, with the conversion of Constantine in 312, come to dominate it. Sedentop even claims that Paul's vision on the road to Damascus amounted to the discovery of human freedom, of a moral agency potentially available to each and every one, that is, to individuals. St. Paul's notion, he says, of universal freedom, of freedom enjoyed by all, irrespective of status, caste, or indeed gender, was utterly different from the classical notion that freedom was enjoyed only by the privileged class of male citizens in the polis, which reflected the assumption of natural inequality at the foundation of classical philosophy. The prevailing belief that social status was a reflection of a natural order of things, and that rationality was not equally distributed amongst people, could not stand beside the Christian insistence on the moral equality of all souls. And thus, when we speak of the Feast of All Souls, we do not reflect on what a radical notion it encompasses, because it conveys the message that all souls are of equal value to God. St. Paul found in the universality of God's love the means whereby every soul is set free. It was this revolutionary moral message which would foster Christian understanding of community as the free association of the wills of morally equal agents, what St. Paul called the body of Christ. The reason this idea was so challenging at the time was that it created a link between divine will and human agency. That link was individual conscience. Joyce Shin of the University of Chicago writes in her paper, Accommodating the Other's Conscience, St. Paul's Approach to Religious Tolerance, that St. Paul's main contribution to the evolving concept of conscience was his recognition of the autonomy of the individual's conscience. Rather than being tied by predetermined social roles, St. Paul conceived of human association being guided by individuals of free will, coming together around shared beliefs and guided by an informed conscience. The challenge to individuals was to reach for moral universality of their own accord, acting through that informed conscience. According to Rudolf Bultmann in his Theology of the New Testament, conscience means the self-knowledge, the self's knowledge of itself in responsibility to the transcendent power of God. The idea that belief in Christ brought about equality of souls, subverting conventional social roles, meant that such considerations became secondary in the eyes of God. Christian liberty is open to all humans, but it is ultimately achieved upon submission to God, and hence the paradox: we achieve freedom through submission. Seton Top argues that these ideas provided the ontological foundation of individualism, insofar as they link meaning to conscience, to the faith of the person concerned, rather than the person to their position in the social order. Joyce Shin argues that attempts to ground religious tolerance in autonomy of conscience generally assume one or both of the following concepts. First, the notion that each person possesses knowledge of his or her duty to divine or moral law, and that duty gives those beliefs binding force. And secondly, the belief that every conscience is fallible, including one's own, and therefore persons should be tolerant of one another. The second of those points is now largely uncontroversial. However, there is an inherent tension in acting in accordance with what one believes to be right and acting in a way which acknowledges the views and claims of others of the same character. In his time, St. Paul encountered diverse belief systems amongst Jews, pagans, and Christians, and he recognized that conflicts could arise when persons of different consciences interacted. Shin points out that in St. Paul's first letter to the Corinthians, he provides guidance on how to accommodate those differences of belief. St. Paul's view was that at times it is necessary to behave in a way which accords with the beliefs of the person with whom one is interacting, even if one does not share those beliefs. For St. Paul, that adaptability, that capacity to accommodate, was an ethical value. This is, in effect, an approach to religious difference that emphasizes the importance of being accommodating or tolerant. That aspect of Pauline theology is an obvious precursor of modern liberalism's injunction to tolerance of divergent views, even those of which we may disapprove. Some 17 years after the death of Constantine, there was born in Numidia the most important Christian theologian since St. Paul, indeed arguably the most important Christian theologian of all. He is known to us as St. Augustine of Hippo. Augustine developed Pauline theology, in particular on the question of the individual conscience and the relationship of the individual soul with God. And this has led to a lively controversy among scholars about what some have described as Augustinian liberalism. Thus, Professor Paul Whiteman in Toward an Augustinian Liberalism, although beginning with the observation that those familiar with St. Augustine's politics, as he developed them, would see the term Augustinian liberalism as oxymoronic, nevertheless argues that Christians, because they have religious reasons to curb their pride, have reason to be concerned with the political manifestations of that vice, and that Christians, therefore, have reasons to value humility and restraint, fostered by conforming their political advocacy to a liberal principle of political legitimacy if others do the same. Here we see in early outline an argument for pluralism which is recognisably modern. Whiteman notes how inspiration for Augustinian liberals can be drawn from St. Augustine's response to both the pagans and the Christians after the fall of what both thought to be the eternal Roman order. According to Whiteman, St. Augustine warned that both pagans and Christians should not make empire their religion, and that the moral of this Augustinian story is to beware of communitarianism and the reach of the coercive state. As Whiteman contends, the Augustinian liberals were committed to limited government and loyalty to community because they recognised that earthly politics could not satisfy the needs of a human person or community. Seton Top also treats St. Augustine as decisive in the development of the moral notions which would, in later centuries, evolve into what we now recognise as liberalism. In particular, Augustine built on St. Paul to emphasise the fragility of the human will. He notes that St. Augustine's intense account of his own relationship with God in his autobiography, The Confessions, has led some to attribute to him the birth of the concept of the individual, inventing the individual in the sense of acknowledging the equality of humans in the face of their maker, is not something that leads to isolation. Indeed, embracing or grasping the concept of the individual removes social class and status, clarifying the conditions that make true freedom possible. But for St. Augustine, reason alone is not sufficient to motivate ethical behaviour. It must be accompanied, it must be invested with the grace of God. Seton Top outlines how St. Augustine understood this grace to motivate individuals to exercise their free will in order to ascend from everyday-based desires to higher realms of thought and action. For relying on reason alone, individuals are victims of self-delusion, and without the feeling brought about by grace, the will is weakened. In this way, conscious action of the individual is understood as a merger between intellect and feeling. St. Augustine's belief that people are equally able to access God's divine power and to be the beneficiary of God's eternal love destroyed his formerly held belief in the moral superiority of some, those in positions of power, which early in his life he had accepted. It led him ultimately to the same conclusion as St. Paul, that the idea of the innate superiority of some people by reason of social structure had to be abandoned. St. Augustine's conception of human beings highlights our fallibility. His emphasis on the complexity and frailty of the human will and on the role of grace in human motivation made him sceptical of the potential for perfection in human beings and in the institutions and societies that they create. Once again, we see in this argument a distinctly modern flavour. This is the same argument against the totalitarian state which has been made by liberals throughout the 19th and 20th centuries. It calls to mind Immanuel Kant's remark, "From the crooked timber of humanity, no straight thing was ever made." For St. Augustine, an individual's relationship with God is paramount, and the focus is on the eternal city of God rather than the city of man. And since only in the city of God is mankind perfectible, the attempt of the secular authority, the governors of the city of man, to impose a specious perfection upon citizens is a profound wrong. Acceptance of that conclusion freed believers from looking to the conventions of their society and the boundaries set by government as sources of meaning, to focus on a better hope by way of a more personal approach to God through humility and prayer. Augustine's emphasis upon the centrality of humility and prayer as a means to salvation, as a bridge to communicate with God, and his understanding of human frailty and moral imperfectibility is inimical to any notion that religious belief might be forced on another, including by the state. The idea that we might fail in moral terms is fundamentally egalitarian and an approach to religion in which those in positions of power command the belief systems of those of lower station. Now, one would rarely hear mention of St. Paul or St. Augustine in the political philosophy classes of a modern Australian university, except perhaps this university, or I dare say in any Western university. One would be unlikely to find a professor of human rights law who acknowledged that human rights owed more to the Christian Church than they did to the United Nations. Yet, the authors of the greatest affirmation of human rights ever penned, the Declaration of Independence, suffered no such limitation of their vision. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. To secure these rights, governments are instituted among men deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Thomas Jefferson was, of course, in every sense a man of the Enlightenment. Indeed, some would argue he was the Enlightenment's most famous son. Yet Jefferson had no difficulty in accepting that the ultimate source of human rights is not any secular authority, but that they are an endowment of the Creator. And there is no doubt, of course, about the divinity to whom he was referring. I do not say, of course, that human rights may not have a secular derivation. My concern is that, to an extent that is so frequent as to be almost universal, the discourse of human rights is conducted in purely secular terms. As I've argued in this lecture, this is partly due to the prevailing historical assumption that human rights and the liberal premises which underlie them are a product of the modern world alone. Yet, as the scholars to whom I've referred this evening demonstrate, and as Larry Seedentop in particular in his important new book powerfully argues, the governing ethical principle which underlies our modern understanding of human rights, the moral equality of every human person and the right to liberty that follows from that, is a notion which had its origins in the Gospels, as developed and explained by the early Christian fathers, theologians, and canon lawyers. And if that be so, those who actually attack Christianity in the name of some personal view of human rights commit an egregious travesty. Religious belief is central to the human condition. Faith provides a means to help people that cannot be explained, even though it might be apprehended. It can also enable us to see ourselves as part of something larger, and thereby free ourselves from our base, everyday, selfish concerns. Faith also has a unique ability to provide consolation in the face of life's vicissitudes, and to help us to cope with its hardships. Religious institutions have a remarkable capacity to draw people together, to work towards common causes, to provide communities to assist those who are less fortunate. They continue to make a deep contribution to our society, building on their long history and proud institutional strength. They are in many ways the backbone of care and support outside the family. The Australia we know today is home to a diversity of faiths united by tolerance, mutual respect, and a commitment to democracy. Australians are free to choose their religion, and are able to express and practice their beliefs without intimidation and without interference within the framework of Australian law. And any attempt, such as Professor Quinlan has referenced in his introduction, to interfere with that freedom is a profound outrage against our nation. Our founding fathers regarded religious freedom as a value so important that they actually enshrined it in the Constitution in Section 116, one of the very few rights expressly conferred by that famously pragmatic document. As we proceed in Australia to develop a fuller, richer, more balanced understanding of human rights, an understanding which restores the freedom of the individual to the centre of the debate, which is where it should be, let us ensure that we do not neglect the importance of religious liberty. And let us acknowledge the debt which our modern conception of human rights owes to the teachings and traditions of the Christian Church. Thank you.
Before I issue the vote of thanks, the Senator, Mr. Attorney, has agreed to take some questions, but I'll moderate the questions. Does anybody have one? We have a nervous audience.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney, for the talk. It's a terrific talk. Question I have to ask is, of course, talking about our personal freedoms and the rights of different people to marry. I was wondering if it might be counterintuitive, but in fact, considering that the law is very well established around de facto relationships, that the test is of a bona fide domestic relationship. In fact, if you abolished the Marriage Act and just made a test of a bona fide domestic relationship as the law for the division of property in the care of children, rather than thus leaving the idea of going through the sacrament of marriage, which I very strongly believe in, as being one of personal choice, and of the church being able to confer, whatever church, whatever religion wishes to confer it, or indeed any secular institution, but it not be the test of a bona fide domestic relationship, but it just be one of the indicia. It would remove the divorce as a legal institution, and it would make it simply a test on whether or not you'd commingled your finances, raised children together, or cohabited.
Well, I've heard that argument often. The implication of it, though, is this, that one would recognise as marriages only ceremonies which have a religious or a sacramental significance to the participants. Now, about not quite 70% of marriages in Australia today are secular marriages. They're not conducted in a church. They're not religious. They're not sacramental. So the implications of the view you put are that the 70% of Australians who want to marry but don't want to or don't marry in church should not have their relationship regarded as a marriage. Now, I don't think that would be a position acceptable to many people. We are very comfortable we've only known the idea of secular marriage side by side with religious marriage. Originally, marriage was only a religious institution. An act of the British Parliament in our system changed that more than 200 years ago. But our understanding of marriage has evolved to the point where it went more than two centuries ago from being exclusively a religious institution to being an institution that could be entered into by people without benefit of a religious ceremony. And then it's evolved in other ways over the years as well. Most importantly, I suspect, in recent memory, during the time of the Whitlam government, by the Family Law Act, which effectively made marriages terminable at will, rather than the position that had been the case before that. Marriage should be something that reflects society's fundamental values, but I don't accept the implicit proposition in your question that the institution of marriage should only be available to people who want to undergo a religious form of marriage ceremony.
Question at the back.
That was fascinating, Mr. Attorney. It's interesting when you were saying that modern human rights owes a considerable weight to Augustinian liberalism and to the early Christian tradition and canon law, etc. Counterweighting that, it seems to me, is the manifestation of enormous economic crisis in early 20th century modernity, which caused enormous ideological upheaval throughout Europe, and there was enormous victimization of racial minority groups, and also the Jewish religious ethnocultural group. If you think about it, it was almost like some sort of a ultra nihilistic teleology of that process of secularization which was developing in early modernity, and it was out of that manifestation of crisis that the UM was formed to try and prevent any repetition of that kind of upheaval.
Well, the events that you describe, like, for example, the Bolshevik Revolution, the Ukrainian famine, the Armenian genocide, those are the sorts of events I assume you are thinking about. They, of course, were all events that the Christian Church, and not just the Christian Church, would have regarded as very grave sins. So I don't say, and I made this point expressly clear in my talk, I don't say that Christian values, or even more broadly religious values, are the only source of human rights. They're not. There are secular sources of human rights as well, but my concern is that in a debate dominated by the secular, there is a neglect or maybe even a willful ignorance of the fact that the earliest morality from which our discourse about human rights derives is actually a Christian morality.
Angelo.
Thank you for that wonderful talk. So I was just curious what you thought the correct balance to be reached was between protecting the legitimate religious beliefs and practices of individuals are on one hand, and protecting the nation, the community, against political/religious ideologies that seek to overthrow the state inherently?
Well, that's a very difficult question, and of course it's a question with which we're struggling at the moment, or at least we're seeking to find the answer to at the moment. And I think the answer lies in the way in which you've phrased your question, if I may say so. We shouldn't conflate a religious faith with a political ideology. And the violent prosecution of a political ideology is not the profession of a religious faith, even if that's the way in the minds of some it is dressed up. And if I'm wrong about that, and theologians say, well, according to some interpretations of particular religions, there is a violent dimension to their theology, then our society has a right to say You are not at liberty at the expense of the safety and life and well-being of other people to prosecute that belief.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney. Currently, about 20% of all Australian children are in Catholic schools. Now, these schools have freedom to select the staff according to established criteria. Would you like just to make a comment on this freedom and perhaps looking into the future a bit?
Well, I support that freedom. I think that schools ought to be allowed to provide an education so that parents can ensure that their children are brought up in accordance with the tenets of their faith. And that will, on occasion, be reflected in the staff, the school, a choice that the schools make about the employment of staff. I know that where you're getting at, and I understand there are difficult issues here. When one chooses to employ people, then one must make sure that one doesn't unfairly discriminate against them. So just like the previous questioner, this is a question of the question you pose is also a question of reconciling competing values. I don't think, though, that a religious school should, for example, be required to employ a person whose beliefs and practices are offensive to the very faith that religion seeks to teach, that school seeks to teach. Now, having said that, I'm talking about cases where the individual staff member concerned actually in their daily working life, not in their personal life, but in their daily working life, would attempt to subvert the religious teaching, just as I couldn't be expected to employ on my staff somebody who was an active member of the Labor Party. That would be silly. I think that principle that nobody should have to employ somebody who would actually work against the very thing they are legitimately seeking to achieve. So we need to be very careful not to unfairly discriminate against people. And I think that the case you're positing would apply in a relatively small number of cases and should only apply. We should be very, very careful and judicious. But I think the principle that a religious school should not be forced to employ someone who would actively seek to, by their advertent conduct in the workplace, subvert the teachings of the church, is a fair principle.
That was a lecture by Senator George Brandis at the University of Notre Dame, Australia. And for more interviews, talks, and shows, visit cradio.org.au.